Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sean McDermott, registration number 21965. I represent the three appellants in this consolidated appeal, Ms. Mills, Ms. Wallace, and Mr. Hogan. As the court is aware, this case, this appeal, involves the proper scope of short-term disability benefits that are available to Colorado members of the Public Employees Retirement Association. It's a pleasure to appear before the panel today. The issue to be resolved is one that has been a long time coming. It's an issue of first impression for this court, at least that's what my review of the case law reveals. It's the first time that the issue of the scope of the para short-term disability benefit has been addressed to the Court of Appeals or to the Supreme Court. The question that this court must address is whether para and its designated disability program administrator, formerly Standard Insurance, that is now Unum Insurance, is administering the program in compliance with the law, specifically whether PARA's adoption of PARA Rule 7.45 subsection E was beyond its statutory authority. Now, my office has represented dozens of PARA members over the years, perhaps dating back at least a decade or so. This is an issue that has come up many, many times, and it continues to come up, even under the short-term disability policy that now governs the same program that has been issued by Unum Insurance. We have had, as far as I know, there's only been two rulings from district court judges on this issue. They are conflicting rulings. Following the ruling that was issued by Judge Plow in the Nunez case approximately 4 years ago, these three cases arose and were filed by my office in Denver District Court. One of these cases seeks class action status. The reason we did that is because this issue does need to be resolved. The issue is whether or not under the short-term disability policy issued by Standard, the second prong of the definition, which is modeled after Rule 7.45E, is properly in place.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? I take it they reached the opposite conclusion in the trial court in Nunez?
Yes, Judge Plow found that the 7.45E was not consistent with the law.
And did anybody appeal that decision?
No, that case, all the same lawyers were involved in that case. That case settled approximately 4 weeks before trial.
Thank you.
All of the appellants here have been denied their parent short-term disability benefits, even though the disability program administrator, Standard Insurance, whose job it is to render these decisions, PARA doesn't make the decisions, PARA simply processes the application, sends them on to the disability program administrator. The administrator, Standard, investigates the claim, renders a claim decision, and here found that each of my clients is incapable of doing their own job. That language specifically exists in each of the denial letters. My clients cannot do their own job. The statute, which defines short-term disability, says that's all you have to show, the inability to perform the essential functions of the member's job. All of my clients have been denied valuable and needed income replacement benefits, and they've been denied under the second prong of the definition. Each of these denial letters stated that my clients, or concluded that my clients, were capable of earning more than 75% in some other occupation.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. You don't think that there's any ambiguity in this statute?
Absolutely not. In fact, even though the trial court here found that there was an ambiguity, I would point out that none of the parties argued that. And in reviewing the briefs before the panel today, I still believe, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, that no party is actually arguing that the statute is ambiguous. Frankly, I'm not sure how the trial court got to that conclusion, but that's not relevant because the panel is charged with a de novo review here. When you look at the statute itself, I guess let me back up a second. In preparing for today's argument, I was rather amazed that I had to read hundreds of pages of briefs addressing this issue, which is so very obvious. This issue could be summarized and argued probably in two pages, and you can do that by simply looking at the statute, because the statute actually answers the question. Excuse me. I'd like to
Let me turn you to the term of the statute. If you could just address this, there's a comma about who is not totally and permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment, comma. What does that term mean? Is that referencing B?
Yeah, it is referencing B, and that's exactly where I was going.
Sorry to interrupt. I just had
no problem.
Question.
In fact, this is basically an argument that, looking back through our briefs, we did not specifically point this out. But I think when you look at this clause, it answers the question for us. The court, or Judge Furman, you're referring to section 24-51-702 in the statute, subsection 1, subsection A. That is the statute that where short-term disability is defined. Subsection B defines disability retirement. If you allow me to read subsection A, a member who is found by the disability program administrator, that is what standard is now Unum, to be mentally or physically incapacitated from performance of the essential functions of the member's job with reasonable accommodation as required by federal law, but who is not totally and permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment, shall be provided with, and then it goes on to describe what types of benefits PARA may offer. That particular phrase, but who is not totally and permanently incapacitated from regular or substantial gainful employment, when you move down in the statute, that is the definition for disability retirement. If you look at subparagraph B, it's word for word in there. What the legislature was specifically telling us when you look at the statute is that you, in determining whether or not someone's entitled, a PARA member is entitled to short-term disability, you do not look at whether or not they're capable of regular and substantial gainful employment. We're told that in the statute. Now, we spent a lot of time in the briefs arguing that the law is clear. We looked at the legislative history. We have cited to various senators' statements at the committee hearings. We cited to the testimony of the former director of benefits for PARA. Because you have to keep in mind, it was PARA in 1997 that proposed these changes to the legislature. And we have to keep in mind, I suggest the panel needs to keep in mind that, or the reason for those changes. Before 1999, there was only one disability benefit that was available for a PARA member, and that was disability retirement. You were entitled to disability retirement if you couldn't do your own job. Now, I am paraphrasing, but basically when you look at the definition, that's what it was, an inability to do your own job. If you couldn't do your own job as a PARA member, didn't matter if you could go do some other job. Didn't matter if you could go do some other job and make even more money. You were entitled to disability retirement, and there were no offsets or reductions built into the system for the other income that would have been earned by that individual. It was Colorado PARA that decided this was unfair. There's even testimony in our briefs from a member of the Board of Trustees that she thought that the system before was crazy. And they fixed the problem. They went to the legislature and they proposed a two-tiered system. This is the system that was adopted and implemented starting January 1st, 1999. This new system is laid out in the statute. Short-term disability and disability retirement. What PARA wanted and what the legislature gave to them was a disability retirement program that was no longer an ONOC, but the ONOC was shortened down to short-term disability. Disability retirement that could last a lifetime was now redefined. No longer own job, but the inability to earn a substantial gainful wage. This is what the statute says.
Okay, so Mr. McDermott, what happens when you hit short-term disability? Then you're entitled to either reasonable income replacement or rehabilitation or retraining services, which implies that you might be retrained for some different job, not the member's own job. Doesn't PARA get to decide for the standards for what is reasonable income replacement?
Sure, and they've done it. In adopting the rules, PARA, before they adopted the rules, PARA was given the choice by the statute to either offer reasonable income replacement, comma, or rehabilitation or retraining, comma, or a combination thereof.
Well, if a person can perform some other job and get 75% of salary, maybe it's not reasonable to provide income replacement at that point.
But that's not the way it was. That's not how they chose to propose it to the legislature, and that's not how the legislature set it up. The short-term disability program is designed to allow somebody who wants to stay in their own job, if they become injured traumatically, if they have a chronic disease that they're trying to battle with and hopefully can overcome, they have a time period where they can either be rehabilitated or they can go through retraining to get themselves back to that job. And if they can't get themselves back to that job before the end of the 22 months, then they can go get another job, hopefully that makes more than 75%, such that they're not entitled to disability retirement. But if the retraining doesn't result in that, and they're not able to make the 75%, then they're put onto disability retirement. What I'd like to mention about the retraining, and this is important, is PARA was given the option of offering either reasonable income replacement or rehabilitation or retraining, and I believe I pointed this out in my brief. Nowhere in the PARA rules did they choose to offer retraining. It is not in there. They were given the option by the legislator to offer that as a benefit for someone who meets the definition of short-term disability, but they didn't. What they offered was reasonable income replacement, and they had the authority, the discretionary authority, to determine what reasonable income is, and they decided that would be 60%.
Well, let me ask you this. So you would not construe the statute, whoever qualifies for short-term disability shall be provided with reasonable income replacement or reasonable income. You would not construe that to mean there are some circumstances in which a reasonable training or reasonable income replacement would be zero.
As far as the, I guess I didn't understand.
No, question. No, actually, I think you did understand it. It is kind of like, could a person eligible for short-term disability be provided with reasonable income or reasonable training in the form of no training or no income?
It was up to PARA to decide whether to offer retraining or not, and they haven't. But they could have. They could have offered retraining.
How about no income replacement?
They could have offered no income replacement. They could have only offered, according to the statute, rehabilitation or retraining, or a combination thereof. And what they have actually done when you look at the rules.
Could you offer no rehabilitation or training?
But you have to offer something under the statute. You have to offer, because it uses the word shall be provided with either reasonable income replacement or rehabilitation or retraining.
Can reasonable income replacement be zero under the circumstances?
Reasonable income replacement could not, I would submit, is not reasonable. It's not income replacement, so it can't be zero. When you look at the typical group disability policy that exists in the private sector, the type of income replacement that you see is often 60% of your pre-disability earnings. That's very typical. I've read hundreds of these policies over my career, and perhaps the panel has as well. And when the system was designed by PARA and they adopted the rules, they adopted the income replacement level, which is required by statute to be reasonable, at 60%. So as far as whether or not they can offer no income replacement, perhaps they could, but only if they also offered rehabilitation or retraining. They have to offer something.
Well, I don't want to speak for Judge Daly, but my understanding of his question is that we're not talking about the percentage of income replacement. We're talking about the circumstances under which someone might or might not be entitled to income replacement at all. It might be unreasonable to provide income replacement if they can earn 75% of their salary at some other job.
I think that question is actually answered by Senator Wells, which we cited in the language, where he said that the, if I may quote from this, and this is from the Senate hearings, what the bill provides here is that you are unable to do it, meaning your own job, but you can be gainfully substantially employed. In other words, you can get a full-time job doing something else. Then what we're going to do is just put you on short-term disability. That was the purpose. Even if you can go do something else, you're entitled to short-term disability to give you the opportunity to try to get back to your own job. Now, there's built-in income reductions now built into the system, such that if the person can't do their own job, but they actually go out and work and make money, there is a provision in the rules, and there's a provision in the short-term disability policy that allows there to be a reduction of the amount that actually has to be paid.
Counsel, I don't want to eat up all your rebuttal time, but Senator Wells goes on to say, and then allow for payment for the re-education or payment or retraining or whatever is appropriate. My impression of reading through, reviewing the legislative testimony is that they weren't really contemplating a situation where someone could do a substantial portion of another job. They were sort of thinking about rehabilitation where you needed retraining for another job, but not someone who's immediately able to go to another job.
Well, I guess that could be a fair reading of that. The problem with how it actually works in practice is if you're found to meet this definition, you're unable to do your own job. I have these clients and many other clients who have been offered nothing. They're not offered re-education. They're not offered retraining. They're not offered rehabilitation. They're not given any reasonable income replacement. What they end up doing is sitting at home, not having a job, not having an income, and they get terminated. So they meet the statutory definition, but they receive nothing. I'd like to reserve what limited time I have left for a while.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Bailiff, would you add 2 minutes on to counsel's rebuttal, as well as 2 minutes on to appellee's time as well? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Gary Kramer, registration 21167. I represent Para. We do have two appellees in this matter, and Mr. Von Schleicher and I have agreed to share our time equally this morning. Although I don't intend to use all of the time allotted to me, because I intend only to emphasize 3 points from our brief. The first is, as counsel indicated, in 1997, the General Assembly made sweeping changes to the Para Disability Program. Under the prior program, Para members were awarded a lifetime retirement benefit if they were unable to perform their own job, even if they recovered to the point where they could go back to work in a different job. In the 1997 legislation, the General Assembly directed Para to add a short-term disability component to its disability program. The legislature's objective was to get Para members back to work as soon as possible and off disability. And for that reason, the legislature authorized Para to provide its members with rehabilitation and retraining services, in addition to, or at Para's option, instead of short-term income replacement payments. Retraining, as Judge Boris noted, means training for a different job. The General Assembly's deliberate use of the word retraining in the statute indicates that its intent was to get Para members back to work in any job and not just their own job.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. I'll start off with the same question. Is there any ambiguity in this statute?
We agree with counsel for appellants, Your Honor, that the statute is not ambiguous. Although the district court reached its result by determining that the statute was ambiguous and resorted to the legislative history, we do not believe it is ambiguous. We believe that the application of the ordinary rules of statutory construction, construing the statute as a whole, harmonizing all of its provisions, giving effect to the meaning of all of its words, leads to the same conclusion that the district court reached.
So let me ask this then, because in reading 702, it says, a member who is found by the disability program administrator to be incapacitated from the performance of the essential functions of, quote, the member's job. How does that lead to a different job? Because you went from there to retraining, implying a different job. And it seems to me the retraining would go directly toward that clause in the statute.
Your Honor, I don't agree. What 702 does, it does not define disability as counsel suggests. What 702 does, parts 1A and 1B, is it sets forth the general framework of the two-tier disability program. Okay. What the legislature does is it uses this phrase, permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment, but it doesn't define that term. So what it tells Para is, for those members who are permanently...
Wait, repeat that, because I've got it right in front of me. What does it say?
In 702,
right.
In both 1A and 1B, it uses the phrase permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment.
But doesn't that refer to retirement disability?
Yeah,
and not
that's within retirement. And in A, short term, it says, but who is not. So I think that is an exception under A.
We don't read it as an exception. Para didn't read it as an exception. What it does is
the word but.
Yes. But who is not, that's correct. What the statute does is it distinguishes between the short-term program and the disability retirement program.
Okay.
Those members who are totally and permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment are put in the disability retirement program.
Understood.
Those members who are not totally and permanently incapacitated from regular and substantial gainful employment are put in short-term disability.
Provided they cannot perform the essential functions of the member's job.
That's correct. And they are considered for either income replacement, reasonable income replacement, or retraining or rehabilitation services. And I'd like to point out there is a very important phrase that counsel assiduously avoided in his argument, for a period specified in rules adopted by the board. And the second point that I would like to make is that the legislature has vested PARA with very broad authority to design its disability program. Rule 703 delegates very broad authority to PARA to adopt rules relating to the program, including, most specifically, rules with respect to standards relating to the determination of disability. Further, in Rule 703, the legislature delegated to PARA the authority to adopt a rule with respect to the adjustment or termination of payments based on the mental or physical condition of the program participant. It's important to point out what the statute does not say, either in 702.1a or in 703. The statute does not say that payments must continue until the member is capable of returning to the member's own job. That's not what it says. It delegates to PARA the authority to determine when payments cease based on the physical or mental condition of the program participant. And PARA determined that if the program participant is capable of earning 75% of his or her own pre-disability earnings in any job, then disability payments need not be made. Or, as the court pointed out earlier, they're not reasonable in that situation. Finally, I'd like to point out, in 2009, the Colorado General Assembly looked at the Colorado PARA Disability Program. It was in the context of a merger of the Denver Public Schools Retirement System with PARA. The General Assembly looked at the PARA Disability Program and it enacted a new subsection 4 to section 2451701. New subsection 4 said, from now on, DPS disability applications shall be governed by the PARA Disability Program. The PARA rules, including Rule 7.45E, have been in effect since January 1, 1999. They've been in effect now for over 14 years, and they were in effect for many years when the legislature specifically took a look at the PARA Disability Program. And it said, we like it, and we want you, from now on, to apply those rules to the Denver Public Schools disability applications. And the legislature's review of the statute, of the rules, excuse me, and its failure to enact correcting legislation to Rule 7.45E or to any other PARA rule may be presumed by this court to be a legislative ratification of PARA's rules.
Do we have any authority indicating an inaction by a subsequent legislature indicates approval of prior rules adopted by a regulatory body? Did you cite us any authority on that?
We cited, Your Honor, authority to the effect that in the Supreme Court case, and I can get the cite in a moment.
That's okay.
The Supreme Court has said very specifically that when a legislature amends a statute, it is presumed to ratify the rules or the interpretation by the administrative body that is in charge of interpreting the statute through its rules. And yes, we have cited those cases in our briefs. And with that, I thank the court and ask the court to affirm the decisions below. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Warren Von Schleicher. I am an attorney for the defendant appellee Standard Insurance Company, and my registration number is 11PHV3096, and I've been admitted for this appeal pro hoc vice. Counsel for plaintiff presents this case as being very simple. In fact, it is complex. What the plaintiff proposes to do is to ask the Court of Appeals to declare PERA's Rule 7.45A, ultra vires and unconstitutional. Then the plaintiff wants the Court of Appeals to rewrite PERA's rules and redesign the program to provide benefits to individuals that he represents. And then third, he asks the court, after judicially rewriting PERA's rules and judicially redesigning the welfare program, to judicially rewrite the group policy issued by Standard under the rubric of reformation of contract. And it's our position that that's a process that the court can't engage in past step one. If the Court of Appeals is to find that PERA's rules are ultra vires and unconstitutional, the judicial function ends. The court's role ends when an unconstitutional rule is laid bare. Plaintiffs contend that the court merely needs to blue pencil Rule 7.45E, but the effect of striking that provision is in effect to make a determination about the nature of the benefits to be provided to people who are able to work in other occupations but not able to do their own state job.
Is that our job or is that the legislature's job? I think you're suggesting that he wants us to do it, but on the other hand, I thought his position was, what did the legislature want to have done? And I think that is something the judges can determine.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the General Assembly did is authorize PERA to design and provide a disability program within the general framework. So it may be that if the court finds that PERA's rule is unconstitutional, PERA may, within the authority given by the General Assembly, decide that the group of individuals represented by a plaintiff's counsel, those who can work in another occupation, they might get a lesser amount of benefits or no income replacement benefits at all. They should get retraining or rehabilitation. The selection of the type of benefits is purely a core legislative function, and it's not something that's mandated by the General Assembly statute in 702. And that's why the judicial function must end if the court determines that PERA's rule is unconstitutional, because the selection of benefits is a weighing process. It involves public policy. It involves the balancing of costs. If this group of individuals must be given a benefit, PERA has to weigh and balance what can be afforded. What's the impact on the state? These are purely legislative considerations.
Sorry to interrupt. The legislature, just in reading 702.1, appears to have given PERA some discretion. There's three different options or combination. I guess there's more than three, because there's a combination thereof. That would not be a court function, is what you were saying. That would be a PERA function, provided that the statute is not in any way ambiguous.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, I would like to address an argument that both PERA and plaintiff's counsel make. They argue that if the rule is unconstitutional,
let me ask you this, counsel, before we go on, because you've emphasized unconstitutional ultra vires. I take it by this you're trying to indicate that there is an obligation before we would invalidate or interpret the rule or the statute differently, that we have to find that the interpretation would be supported beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that what you're trying to argue?
Well, I think that's an aspect of the argument. Clearly, when the General Assembly delegated broad discretionary powers to...
I notice in one of the briefs there are cases cited for that the rule has to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's correct.
Does that principle apply when the only argument for invalidity is they exceeded the statutory authority? In other words, when the invalidity of the rule is based on a claim that they exceeded the statutory authority, is that same showing of beyond a reasonable doubt required?
No, I think they're two different standards. I think in determining if the court, determining if PERA exceeded its statutory authority, the court applies a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But if the rule is against the clear language of the statute, one does not then give deference. A clear violation isn't entitled to deference. But I do think that the General Assembly in 702 provided a statute that's sufficiently capacious that it embraces the interpretation and the program established by PARA by use of the terms like reasonable, which gives to PARA the power to determine what is reasonable and what is not reasonable, as well as determining whether the period of time for benefits, as well as what type of benefits, including no monetary benefit at all. Now, counsel for both sides have argued that...
Wait, let me ask you this, including no monetary and no training benefit at all? Could they reasonably conclude that there's no benefits available to someone under this statute?
Yes, I believe that that's the case, and I believe that the standard there would be beyond a reasonable doubt, because I don't think this statute clearly mandates the payment of a specific benefit to people who are able to, and in fact working and earning full salary in another occupation. The language here, if the General Assembly wanted to require PARA to provide a benefit, it did not have to use the word reasonable. Reasonable gave PARA significant authority to determine if and how much and whether an income replacement benefit should be paid.
Well, it certainly gives PARA the authority to determine how much, but I think it's a little less clear that it gives PARA the authority to determine if.
Well, within the statute itself, PARA has the authority to determine that nobody gets an income replacement benefit.
Because they would offer rehabilitation or retraining service.
That's one aspect. But I think also that PARA, and again, one thing I want to emphasize as I weigh into this, is that Standard is an independent contractor. We entered a contract with PARA, and PARA is required, and the contract must comply with PARA's rules. So in doing this, Standard, I don't think, is required to and shouldn't have to second-guess the Colorado Attorney General and the administrative process in evaluating this. But to address the question, yes, I think that this statute is sufficiently capacious, that PARA has broad discretion to determine that there's a group of individuals who would not qualify for a benefit.
Counsel, thank you for your time. Your time has expired.
Your Honor, if I may make one point that I
think your time is...
Excuse me?
Your time has expired.
I understand. Thank you,
Counsel. Two minutes. There you go.
Thank you for the additional time. With all due respect for counsel for both defendants, counsel for PARA, the statute does define short-term disability and disability retirement. That's specifically what it is there for. It tells PARA what two benefits you are to provide. That's the PARA that came to them and asked them to define these types of benefits, to create this two-tiered system. It specifically defines what short-term disability should be, and it specifically defines in subsection B what disability retirement should be. And short-term disability is an own job definition. It is not an any gainful occupation definition because the statute tells us that. It uses the word, I brought the wrong booklet up here. It uses the phrase, but who is not totally. It doesn't use the word and, who is also totally and permanently incapacitated from any gainful occupation. Had it meant that, had there been leeway for PARA to incorporate Rule 7.45E into its rule properly, there would have been an and, not a but. It is not a reasonable interpretation of the word reasonable income replacement to conclude that no income replacement is payable. Reasonable does not mean nothing. Reasonable may mean nothing in the context of income replacement if there was the other alternative type of benefit that was actually offered, rehabilitation or retraining, but it wasn't. And my clients have not received it.
Retraining is not part of the program that PARA designed within its discretion when it passed the rules. Retraining appears nowhere. Rehabilitation is only offered under the short-term disability policy, the standard issue, if, and this is in the briefs, if the person is first receiving the disability income replacement benefit. Only then are they obligated or possibly obligated to offer rehabilitation. That's the way PARA chose to design the program. They were granted leeway by the legislature in how to offer the benefits, how long to offer the benefits, how much of a benefit to offer, to design the program with the short-term disability program administrator, how the eligibility is determined, how this should work, the timing of it, when denials should be made, and internal appeals. They can design all that, but what they can't change is who is entitled to the benefit. And who, in this context, is somebody who cannot do their member's own job.
What about the period of time specified in the rules? Can that be zero?
I would suggest not. What's the point? What's the point of the statement? What's the point of offering a benefit if there is no time period by which the benefit has to be offered? Then the entire statute is rendered meaningless if that's a reasonable interpretation. It has to be offered for some period of time. And even if that was a reasonable interpretation, PARA didn't do that. PARA created a 22-month short-term disability program, which would pay a benefit. That's the thing we're all overlooking here, I think, is that they had the leeway to design the program, and they did.
Counsel, I think your time is now expired.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank all three counsel for their arguments today. They were excellent arguments, very helpful. Case will stand submitted. Continue to wish them due course.